Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. In each episode of these podcasts, we examine a key theme driving our world. With access to the world's leading experts, we explore the past, present, and future. Hello, I'm Adam Bolton. Welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. In this episode, we're looking at the possibility of nuclear war, following on from the conflict in Ukraine. In late September, President Putin called for the mobilization of the Russian army to take on Ukraine's resistance to the Russian invasion. He said he would use all the tools at his disposal if the territorial integrity of his country was threatened, adding ominously, "This is not a bluff." Since then, he's upped his rhetoric to a fantastical range of claims and objectives, amongst them his aim to de-Satanize Ukraine. The West, understandably, is nervous, even though the war has not gone Putin's way. But how to judge when a bluff is not a bluff? And as for the tools at his disposal, is he referring to nuclear tactical weapons? And is he really prepared to go nuclear? To discuss this episode, I'm joined by two professors, Wynne Bowen, Professor of Non-Proliferation and International Security in the Department of War Studies, and also co-director of the Freeman Air and Space Institute in the School of Security Studies at King's College London. First, I spoke to Professor Lawrence Friedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies, also from King's College. I began by asking Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman how likely it is that Vladimir Putin will break the taboo on the use of nuclear weapons, which has held since the end of the Second World War.
I don't think it's likely. I don't think it's impossible, which is why it's important to pay attention to it. But I think we have to be careful in distinguishing between the use of nuclear weapons to deter, which I think Putin is doing quite effectively already, and the use of nuclear weapons to coerce a country into doing things it doesn't want to or to help on the battlefield, which is what a lot of the discussion has been about. And the problem with that, in addition to the fact that it would break a taboo, cause international outrage, is it's not actually very clear whether it would work for Putin and what the consequences would be. And it would jeopardize the value that he is getting from his nuclear arsenal by persuading the United States and its allies not to get directly involved in the war.
By using them currently, what you mean is the potential uses being deployed as a deterrent, and it's working, and apparently working for both sides, really.
Yes, it's a threat. And so Putin has attacked a non-NATO country, Ukraine, but has not attacked Poland, Estonia, Romania, all of whom are members of NATO and all of whom are helping Ukraine. But Putin made very clear on the day he announced the invasion in a press conference that the real risk of escalation to all-out nuclear war, troops fighting Russian troops in Ukraine, that he has suggested is his red line. And it is a red line that's been accepted by Biden, who has been very clear, for example, when he refused Zelensky's request to establish a no-fly zone quite early in the war when Russia started attacking civilian life in Ukraine. Biden said, no, we're not going to have our aircraft potentially fighting Russian aircraft. So that's why nuclear deterrence is important in this war, and that would be jeopardized if Putin decided to use nuclear weapons to try to turn the battlefield round, which I think would actually be quite a difficult thing to do.
And Zelensky has made it clear now that the Ukrainian war aim, as the defenders, is to go back to pre-2014 borders. In other words, to take back all that region of eastern Ukraine in the Donbass and to take back Crimea. Do you think that's realistic?
Hard to tell. I think... Crimea is a separate issue to some extent, in part because militarily it's quite difficult. And it is more of a thing. And Putin muddied it to some extent by annexing these four other provinces, none of which he's in total occupation of. So to some extent it undermined the special status of Crimea for Russia. But it certainly is an objective for Ukraine, but it's harder. I think if you start to see real military breakthroughs in the Donbass, where the enclaves are, I can't particularly see a reason why the Ukrainians would stop to respect sort of the old borders of the enclave. The only thing that may lead them to hesitate a bit is those areas that have been ruled by separatists since 2014-15 may be more hostile, may put up local resistance. Hard to tell if they really would. So that may make the Kyiv hesitate a bit there. But I think essentially if they have got the military upper hand, they'll carry on. And one has to say that although a lot of people talk about the need for the Ukrainians to negotiate and so on, and maybe this would, the enclaves and Crimea would be an area for negotiation, the Russians haven't actually offered anything that suggests they're prepared to compromise at all on for example, the provinces that they're trying to take at the moment and where they're struggling. So as far as the Ukrainians are concerned, until there's some interest from Russia in a serious negotiation, they're going to push on.
So if we take that scenario, which is, as I understand it, that heading into the winter, you still feel the initiative in this conflict is with Ukraine, why wouldn't Putin, or what are his options to try and shift the balance by using nuclear weapons, perhaps in a demonstration, or perhaps in the battlefield?
I mean, one has to say, we spent most of this year trying to work out what's going on in Putin's mind, and we haven't always got it right, so that's why I'm cautious about being dogmatic on this issue. But there are good reasons why not to use nuclear weapons. The first is this is quite a dispersed battlefield. So the advantage of using so-called tactical nuclear weapons, any use of nuclear weapons would be pretty strategic, but they're called tactical nuclear weapons, is that you need a good concentration of enemy forces to make their use worthwhile. Because otherwise you're creating a big hole in the battlefield. You'll kill a number of people, but it may actually not be enough to make a difference unless you use them in numbers. And then your problem is they're quite close to Russian forces. So you're relying on systems to deliver these weapons that haven't been tested. You don't know whether the weapons will actually work as advertised. The missiles with conventional warheads have been inaccurate. Some have been shot down. I mean, it all may just go terribly wrong, even if you tried it. And you wouldn't necessarily achieve very much. And once you've used nuclear weapons, then you really don't know what the response is. The Americans and allies have said the responses would be severe. Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, described them as catastrophic. It's perfectly possible that once that is passed, then a decision will be made to move in and just take out Russian conventional forces to show that there can be no gain by a method of that sort. A demonstration shot carries all sorts of risks. All it demonstrates is that you're not prepared to use the weapons against real targets. And again, the problem of the demonstration going wrong, which is one reason why the Americans didn't use a demonstration shot to impress the Japanese in 1945. We don't know how the Indians and the Chinese and other members of the global South would respond, probably pretty negatively. So it may achieve objectives for Putin.
What would be the drawback of, say, exploding a device over Snake Island or something like that? I mean, what have we learned from the American experience?
Well, I mean, the weapons that would be used in these sort of scenarios, some are smaller than those that destroyed Hiroshima. In fact, a lot of them would be smaller than those that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Others would be bigger. But if he's going to use a nuclear weapon against a city, clearly a war crime. And there's no, and if you look at other things that Putin has tried to do, and we had this with this sort of strange talk of a dirty bomb. One should emphasize that a dirty bomb is just an ordinary bomb with radiation in it. So it irradiates an area. It's nothing like a nuclear explosion. All of this suggests that the Russian approach when considering an atrocity is to find a way of blaming the Ukrainians for doing it to themselves in some way. There's no way he could blame anybody else but Russia for doing something like this. There's no way to hide if this is what he's done. And there's still no guarantee that having done it, that it will have the coercive effect that he wants. And it may well bring the West into a war. And his forces are in no fit state to fight NATO countries if you're going to escalate to that level. I see no real advantages in Russia moving in that direction. It may suit him for us to worry about it, but I don't see any advantages in actually doing it.
And if nuclear weapons were used, what do we know about the NATO response, about the Western response? As I understand it, there's more or less a guarantee that there wouldn't be a response in kind with nuclear weapons.
I think when we are assuming that a NATO response, or maybe just be individual NATO countries, would be conventional. I don't think they're going to escalate to nuclear use. There'd be no need for them to do so. They could do a lot of damage just using regular forces. My assumption would be that they would not attack Russian territory directly. That would be seen as a further escalation, but would attack Russian ground forces and make their position even less tenable than it is at the moment. That would be my assumption. They may do things like cut out Russian power supplies in places, but I'd be surprised if they did that. I think the most useful and effective thing they can do would be to challenge Russia by demonstrating that it now faces, you know, basically the American Air Force, which is in no position to combat.
So you think there would be the involvement of planes above Ukraine and possibly boots on the ground or not?
I'm not sure they'd even need to do that. I think that would be my assumption. I'm not privy to any NATO plans. These are the sort of things that have been talked about. And I suspect the main objective at the moment is to keep Putin guessing. But you know, going back to my point about deterrence, I think the essential message is that you have actually been able to deter the West using the threat of nuclear use, but you're jeopardising that if you use nuclear weapons when NATO has been restrained. Therefore, don't expect restraint. I think that's the essential message they want to get through. And, you know, if you follow Russian media, which tends to talk about all these things in rather lurid terms, then, you know, they're talking about as if they're at war already with NATO. So I don't think it's a wholly incredible threat of response for Putin. Or he uses them on such a small scale that they make very little difference. And then he's sort of blown this big, scary thing that he's been dangling in front of everybody, if Ukraine is allowed to carry on prosecuting the war as it wishes, without anything to show for it. So I think it just introduces too many uncertainties. Now, all that being said, a point could be reached, when certainly not there yet, where Putin's forces are so clearly losing in Ukraine and being pushed right back that he has to accept something that he's refused to accept up to now, which is that Russia is being defeated by Ukraine. So, you know, that's the point at which people understandably start to get worried about his responses. But I think it behoves us still to talk realistically about what weapons can achieve, rather than just assuming that he will make what would essentially be an emotional response to defeat, which is not going to help him achieve a victory.
I mean, I remain horrified by the images that we've seen in Ukraine, that unprovoked attack by another nation, something that pretty much we hope we'd seen the end of in Europe in 1945, the attacks on civilians. It is just all so shocking. And obviously we had the terrible wars in former Yugoslavia, but they were contained. This involves a sometime superpower. Just finally, obviously no one knows for certain, but your judgment, having looked at so many conflicts, how do you see this conflict developing and ultimately coming to an end?
I've looked at many conflicts. This is a very different one, because there's two different wars being fought. There's a war on the ground, and as things stand, looking at the support that Ukraine has had, the intelligence with which it's used, the equipment that it's been handed over, the determination of the Ukrainian people not to succumb to Russian conquest, you would just say, in the end, they'll win. The Russian armed forces are in a very poor state now. Morale is low. and that they've got the numbers, but you know, with winter coming, they don't particularly have the kit to support people out in the cold. So I would assume that you're likely to see steady Ukrainian progress. But then you've got this other horrific war that's going on, to which the Ukrainians don't have a comparable response of attacks on civilian infrastructure, on residential buildings, which has taken an awful toll. Plus, you know, basic war crimes. Not a lot of international humanitarian law has been respected here. And that's taking its toll. I can't see how it will make the Ukrainians stop fighting, but it doesn't make it any easier for them, and it's going to make for a miserable time. And then you've got this underlying question of what can Russia do in the end to turn this around, and will they accept a negotiated solution? I have to say, my concern at the moment is I can't see Putin accepting defeat if he can possibly avoid it, and therefore will do everything to keep the war going rather than be forced to accept defeat. I think that's just hope that something turns up that moves it in his direction. So I don't think it can be sustained at this level for much longer by either side. It will carry on, I think, for a while. And at some point, in my most optimistic view, the Russian military will accept that their position is untenable and press for a ceasefire of some sort. And that will be a big challenge for Putin if that moment comes. Or else there's going to be so much pressure in Moscow that something breaks there. But there's no definite scenario at the moment. Most wars, you've got a pretty good idea, just looking at the balance of power, how they will end. But this is such a complex fight that's been going on for such many months now, with such a high toll, that neither side is going to be keen to give up soon. On balance, the Ukrainians should, and I think will, prevail. But one shouldn't pretend this is going to be easy.
Professor Lawrence Friedman there. Next, I spoke to Wynne Bowen, Professor of Non-Proliferation and International Security in the Department of War Studies and co-director of the Freeman Air and Space Institute in the School of Security Studies at King's College London. When we talk about the use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine, and people try and draw a distinction between tactical and strategic nuclear weapons, what is the range of things that Russia could do?
I think if we think about the Ukraine war to date, or at least since February 24th, I think at one level, the nuclear card that Russia has played has been about deterring Western, US, NATO direct involvement in the war as beyond provision of equipment and training to the Ukrainians. And that's principally been at the strategic level. And we've seen a lot of nuclear signaling around that, ICBM tests, various statements from Russian officials dialing up and dialing down the threat at different times. So that's at one level.
So that's basically saying to NATO, stay out of this, or we could be in a strategic nuclear war.
I think that's what it's about. It's basically holding that risk in front of NATO to say, okay, you know, if you get directly involved, then nuclear then potentially comes into play at that strategic level. Absolutely, I think. But it also bleeds into the potential sub-strategic or tactical use of nuclear weapons too, which I think is mostly about a threat to potentially use, you know, smaller yield nuclear weapons within Ukraine as part of trying to compel the Ukrainians to come to the negotiating table, and also to put pressure on the West to push Ukraine towards the negotiating table. So a threat at that level, which may come into play at some point. And obviously the concern is that Russia may even employ a low-yield nuclear weapon or two to try to force that if it is not managing to be able to claim some sort of victory in Ukraine.
Of course, it's never been done. Hiroshima, if we look at it, was very much a strategic use of atomic weapons, whereas we've had lots of talk. Of course, I mean, people remember the Green and Common protests, the intermediate nuclear force discussions, talk about tactical weapons. I mean, Have we ever come close to it, do you think, not just in Ukraine, but anywhere in the world since those weapons were developed?
So there have been several sort of nuclear crises during the Cold War at different times, the Cuban Missile Crisis being the most obvious one, concerns around nuclear aspects of the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, the Soviet-Chinese border war, and where, you know, the potential for nuclear use was on the cards. I think one important thing to say, though, is that whilst the word tactical is tied to low-yield nuclear capability, any use of nuclear weapons is strategic, right? Because it's nuclear.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, isn't it? That theoretically, a tactical nuclear weapon ought to be a war-fighting weapon like any other, you know, like the use of drones or whatever. But actually, there is such a taboo about nuclear weapons that it immediately takes things into another plane.
Absolutely, and that's been the case ever since, well, I mean, even 1945 and the US nuclear use in Japan when the United States had an atomic monopoly. Even back then, that was hugely strategic because it was not just about war termination in the Japanese context, it was also, you know, that sent a lot of messages to other countries around the world, notably the Soviet Union as well. And as soon as then, as that atomic monopoly was ended, you know, with the Soviets entering the nuclear club and later on other countries too, then obviously the whole sort of theorizing around deterrence started to really take shape when, you know, there was not one country with nuclear, but several countries over time that had nuclear capability. So I think this debate over strategic and tactical is, it's important, I think, if you're in the sort of the depths of planning new nuclear employment strategy as a way to try to make deterrence credible, because you have options at different sort of rungs of the ladder, if you will, in terms of escalation. But ultimately, any level of nuclear use would be strategic immediately.
And why has the taboo on nuclear remained in place, whereas the one on the use of chemical weapons clearly hasn't?
Well, I would argue that nuclear is the only true weapon of mass destruction in terms of the scale of destruction that comes with it. I think with chemical weapons, for example, you know, unless you're talking about a significantly sized military arsenal in an advanced state, you won't come near the level of destruction that you would do with nuclear. So actually, sometimes how we lump together chemical, biological, nuclear is not necessarily that useful, I think, in analytical terms and in strategic terms. Chemical weapons use, as we saw in Syria, for example, you know, they had an effect, but nothing like, you know, a nuclear effect would have had in a similar circumstance. So I think we've got to be careful about how we judge too much across these different weapons categories when we're thinking about conflict and war.
And at the lowest level, but presumably still pretty terrible, is these so-called dirty bombs. And we've had these rather bizarre claims from Sergei Shoigu on the Russian side, saying that he fears the Ukrainian side might actually use them. What do you make of all that?
Well, to begin with, I think we have to think about, well, what's meant by a dirty bomb, right? So, you know, it's basically, the technical term for it is a radiological dispersal device, where usually conventional explosives of some sort are used to disperse radioactive materials, which could be taken, for example, from spent nuclear fuel from a reactor, or they could involve radioisotopes that are widely used in the medical sector or in industry. And I think most of our thinking about the use of dirty bombs has been framed by the literature and the concern about nuclear terrorism, not necessarily by state use of this type of capability. But in terms of the Russian narrative around Ukraine having a dirty bomb capability and trying to use this, we could interpret that in different ways. I think we should also put in there perhaps the Russian accusations around, you know, bioweapons testing going on in Ukraine as well. Are these scenarios being put in there into the narrative as a means to potentially escalate on the Russian side if it continues to lose conventionally in the war, so that it might think about resorting to low-yield nuclear use using those types of excuses rather than admitting that it's actually losing in a conventional military sense, and that a low-yield nuclear use might be the only thing to take out those sorts of capabilities on the ground? I think essentially there's a huge psychological dimension to any kind of WMD threat. And I think with a radiological dispersal device, then you're talking about, you know, an invisible killer radiation, etc. And that has a particular psychological impact, I think, on unprotected populations, unprotected civilian populations. And in the end, I think, you know, we should interpret this approach potentially as a means to for the Russians to be able to justify escalation or to control escalation. But also it's designed to cause panic and concern in Ukraine. It's designed to cause panic and concern in Western Europe, to play on the political cohesion, which is the alliance's center of gravity, which the Russians have really tried to target in multiple ways, you know, including through the energy weapon, if you will, with the gas and oil aspects. So I think it's about trying to play on those psychological concerns and really trying to, you know, just undermine the stomach for potentially carrying on in this kind of conflict. But it was very interesting that, you know, the Russians, Shoigu, etc., did a lot of communications to a lot of different actors outside of Russia about this. And again, you know, it's difficult to understand exactly how this fits into their playbook.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, given the state of the war where Russia is clearly occupying a lot of territory, but at the same time has been pushed back by Ukrainian forces, and given the state of mind of President Putin and his generals, how close do you think they are to looking for some kind of nuclear option?
So I think prior to the counteroffensive by the Ukrainian forces, you know, early September onwards, my thinking around potential nuclear escalation on the part of the Russians was perhaps if some of their 2014 gains had come under threat. So principally their occupation of Crimea. I think, you know, with the successful counteroffensive that we've seen by the Ukrainians in the east and the south, etc., I think the likelihood of nuclear use has gone up. It doesn't make it likely, but I think the potential for it has increased.
And we had the blowing up of the bridge between Russia and Crimea.
Yeah, exactly. We had that. And I think perhaps more importantly too, you know, we've had the annexation of the four provinces by the Russians, which now, if you look at what Putin has said, and if you look at what Peskov, the press secretary, has said, they've kind of made it pretty clear that Russian nuclear doctrine related to the various scales of threat to Russia that might prompt a nuclear use now includes those four illegally annexed provinces. And again, that's designed to be part of the threat, part of the risk, part of the ambiguity on the Russian side, so that the Ukrainians and its Western partners are super careful about how to continue with the conflict. Part of the debate too, I think, is about, well, what are Putin's ultimate objectives in Ukraine? Is it about subjugating Ukraine? Or is it, you know, if we go back to the draft treaties that Putin put together in December, a US-Russia treaty and a draft Russia-NATO treaty, and his maximalist demands in there, where he talks about, you know, it's all about changing the European security order, and then obviously by definition, really, the global security order. To what extent is Putin now just motivated about being able to claim a victory in Ukraine, just to close off the conflict, claim a victory, where nuclear may play a role, or is it broader? You know, would this just be a step in a broader effort to continue to disrupt the European security order? And I think those sorts of questions are hugely relevant, but I don't have an answer to those, and I'm not sure many people do outside of Putin. I don't think Putin might even know either.
And if you look at where the forces are at the moment, and you were prepared to use nuclear weapons, what tactical use can you see?
So I think in terms of how Russia might use the nuclear lever, if you will, then even if he starts to move around sub-strategic nuclear capability, that's signalling. If he starts to conduct operations in those facilities that house such weapons, you know, even by starting to conduct preparations at those sorts of facilities, that's nuclear signalling. I don't think Putin wants to use nuclear weapons. I think he wants to be able to use the threat of nuclear weapons amongst other threats that he has.
And as far as we know, he hasn't started.
As far as we know. You know, and I think the general assumption is that we would have some sort of, you know, intelligence capabilities would pick up on those sorts of preparations. I don't think we should bank on that necessarily, but, you know, it does seem that some sort of signal would be detected by Western intelligence capabilities. So part of it could be just doing things with those sorts of capabilities. The other parts of the discussion have been around whether Russia might do some sort of nuclear demonstration shot over the Black Sea or test a nuclear device underground at home. And then up step up from that would then obviously be trying to use, you know, nuclear capability against a military formation in Ukraine. And that's one of the questions as well, I think, is if they did opt for nuclear use, would it just be one device or would they use several devices to really drive home a point? And ultimately, the aim for nuclear use would be to bring the different sides to the negotiating table and to bring a huge amount of pressure on Ukraine from the outside world to do that as well.
What would be the consequence of the use of nuclear force? I mean, what has NATO said it would do? Because quite a lot of this, as you say, is about deterrence, about stated policy. Would we back a retaliation using nuclear weapons, for example?
So on the US side, I think it's catastrophic sort of consequences have been communicated to Russia that if nuclear use was to occur. And there's been discussion about, you know, options that the United States in particular could use in retaliation to that. You know, there's been conversations about, or at least speculation in the open source about whether the US could respond by sinking the Black Sea fleet, for example. You know, my view on that is that if that's a retaliation to nuclear use, then expect to have even more nuclear retaliation in return for that sort of action. But, you know, there are no very good options, I think, in the Ukraine war in a general sense. But I think if the Russians were to use nuclear, I think we'd see ramping up, obviously, of conventional military assistance to Ukraine. We'd obviously have to see a huge amount of humanitarian and decontamination assistance, you know, flowing in to the areas affected. Huge diplomatic activity to fully isolate Russia, full imposition of a full embargo, and measures taken by NATO to bolster deterrence of Russian potential horizontal escalation into the alliance.
I mean, as I understand it, but perhaps I'm wrong, it has basically already been stated that even if we were to use nuclear weapons, that NATO, the West, would not retaliate in kind. Is that right? Use nuclear weapons?
It seems that way in terms of the various statements that have been made. I think we have to remember in this context that we're talking about nuclear use or potential nuclear use in Ukraine, which is a non-treaty partner of the NATO alliance. So it's not protected by Article 5.
And your feeling is that the use of nuclear, terrible as it is, taboos that are against it, it wouldn't make NATO basically join in on Ukraine's side and put us into World War III.
My personal view is that I don't think that would happen. I think there are lots of things that the NATO states and, you know, the US in particular can do to keep on ramping the pressure up. But the, you know, there are different options. You could respond to nuclear use by doing something significant with conventional directly against the Russians or with nuclear even. But that's just, I just don't think likely at all because of the huge concerns about escalation. Once nuclear is used, right, we don't know what happens next because we've never had nuclear use in the context of more than one nuclear state, as was the case in 1945.
What about if these nuclear weapons were to be used on supply lines in Poland, for example, which is a NATO member? What would that be? Have more severe consequences?
I think any nuclear use against NATO would have, really severe consequences. And I think that's where we really get into the realm of not knowing what happens next, because nuclear weapons used against the alliance, that would be massively significant. I think what's more likely, actually, to go to your scenario in terms of an escalation potential might be for the Russians to use conventional strike against logistics supply lines just over the border into Poland, for example, just to test the resolve of the alliance. And the Russians could do that and then throw their hands up in the air and say, well, that was an accident. We didn't mean to do that. Sorry. But they've sent a message, you know, so claiming accidental escalation potential, but being deliberate about it. And I think even a conventional use across the border into NATO would really be a test of NATO's resolve as an alliance. And this question of political cohesion would really come to the fore very, very quickly.
Because, I mean, technically, that should trigger Article 5, shouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It would trigger Article 5. But if there was a level of ambiguity added to it on the Russian side, that this was an accident, then that might inject sufficient ambiguity into the situation to complicate NATO thinking and how to respond.
And where does all this leave strategic weapons? Because there have been various treaties between the US and the Soviet Union to reduce nuclear weapons. And when we talk about the reality of using nuclear weapons in the Ukraine, same time we seem to be saying that as far as, you know, the seriously big stuff, if you like, the stuff that you said could assure destruction, that those weapons are pretty much redundant in as much as they're in a standoff of mutually assured destruction. Would that be right?
Well, I don't think they're redundant because they would be providing for that ultimate sort of guarantee of being able to assure destruction against the other side, as you've just said. I think one of the complicating things going forward when we think about arms control, you know, in the United States, there's been a very active debate, particularly involving senior military, about a deterrence and assurance gap that's perceived to be emerging for the US nuclear arsenal. And what they mean by that is that, so Russia has around 2,000 or so non-strategic nuclear weapons. The United States only has a handful of them. And a perception that the United States in particular can't hold at risk the same types of targets that the Russians can hold at risk. And therefore, there's a perception that you somehow need to try to fill that gap a little bit. And then added to that is the whole Chinese nuclear modernization and its shorter range nuclear systems as well. And that we are moving into a tripolar nuclear era, tripolar nuclear deterrence, where the United States, but also NATO and UK, et cetera, are going to have to deal with a much more complicated nuclear environment going forward. And that's going to undermine the prospects, I think, for, you know, significant strategic arms control going forward. And there are even some voices in the United States saying that the United States should get itself out of the New START agreement with the Russians on strategic arms control because of this burgeoning Chinese nuclear capability and having to take that into account, as well as the nuclear risks from Russia that already exist.
And the Chinese presumably are not interested in arms control, are they?
No, they're not even very interested in any level of transparency of their nuclear capability, their nuclear doctrine either. Again, so we are moving, I think, into very uncertain and unsettling times in the world of nuclear weapons politics. And it'll take quite a few years, I think, to work out exactly what a new strategic stability may look like in the future.
And given that, how would the Chinese feel about the use of nuclear weapons by the Russians? Would they see it as a, you know, interesting experiment almost?
I don't think so, no. I think the Chinese would see nuclear use in Ukraine as a disaster. I think, obviously, they've been supportive of the Russians. I think for China, this would be a very unhelpful thing to happen, because it would then shine a lot more light on its nuclear capability, its nuclear ambitions, its regional ambitions, Taiwan, wherever it might be. So I think that it would be seen as, in a negative way. But actually, ultimately, I think, you know, you've got to hope that China is in the background with the Russians saying, look, you can't make this step towards nuclear use. You know, you've got to be very, very careful. We don't want to see this happen. I don't know whether those conversations are happening behind closed doors, but China is the key actor, I think, that would be able to have influence in that respect, just because Russia has become so reliant on China, in particular since the beginning of the war.
So finally, we've lived our lives under the protection of the nuclear umbrella, but going forward, it sounds like you're saying we should be worried.
I think nuclear deterrence is going to remain a significant part of international security. You know, nuclear deterrence has worked for NATO in the Ukraine context. Russia has been deterred from doing anything overtly military against the alliance. There's been some grey zone activities like the Nord Stream pipelines, etc. But, you know, nuclear deterrence is working for the Russians, keeping NATO out from direct military involvement. It's also keeping Russia quite cautious about doing too much against the NATO states as well. So I would argue that it's working. It's just going to become much more complicated in the future with the emergence of China as a really capable nuclear state, and the lessons that that might teach other countries. Potentially other countries may want to go down the nuclear path. So I think it's going to become more complicated. I'm confident that in the long term, you know, through confidence building, a bit more transparency possibly, that understandings can be reached, you know, that were kind of reached between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War about what stability will entail. But we may have to go through some rough seas to get to that point.
That was Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman and Professor Wynne Bowen, both of King's College London. This is a Worldview podcast for Engelsberg Ideas, funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer is Mari Jessel, the assistant producer Eve Webster, and the sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. Until next time, thanks for listening.